Today is Tuesday, May 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. The WHO Director General announces the number of new cases of COVID-19 has outpaced the earliest days of the pandemic.
More cases of COVID-19 have been reported globally in the past 2 weeks than during the first 6 months of the pandemic.
Plus, the Pentagon says it sent 2 planeloads of COVID-19 supplies to India as cases continue to skyrocket, and the dangers of continued conflict in Myanmar. We'll have these stories and more next. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus announced Monday the number of new cases of novel coronavirus infections has outpaced the earliest days of the pandemic.
More cases of COVID-19 have been reported globally in the past 2 weeks than during the first 6 months of the pandemic. India and Brazil account for more than half of last week's cases, but there are many other countries all over the world that face a very fragile situation. In India, WHO is providing critical equipment and supplies, including oxygen concentrators, lab supplies, and mobile field hospitals. We're also providing advice for people on how to provide care at home for families that are unable to find a hospital bed. What's happening in India and Brazil could happen elsewhere unless we all take these public health precautions that WHO has been calling for since the beginning of the pandemic. Vaccines are part of the answer, but they are not the only answer. Next month, leaders from the G7 countries will gather for what may be the most significant meeting in its history. The G7 countries are the world's economic and political leaders. They're also home to many of the world's vaccine producers. We will only solve the vaccine crisis with the leadership of these countries. The Access to COVID-19 Tools Accelerator currently faces a funding gap of $19 billion. And we estimate that we will need a further $35 to $45 billion next year to vaccinate most adults around the world. The G7 countries could mobilize a substantial portion of these funds themselves and lead a global effort to accelerate vaccination around the world.
Globally, there have been more than 153 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, and over 3.2 million deaths have been attributed to the novel coronavirus. That's according to the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 tracker. India itself has reported more than 300,000 new coronavirus infections for a 12th straight day on Monday, taking its overall number of cases to just shy of 20 million. Now, to learn more about the spread of COVID-19 there and what's being done to curb it, I spoke with reporter Anjana Pasricha in Mumbai.
Officials have attributed the second wave to the public abandoning COVID protocols, such as wearing masks and social distancing, after there was a lull in infections earlier in the year. India had returned to pre-pandemic times. Everything was open. Markets, restaurants, weddings were being held. Scientists are also looking into whether more transmissible variants are causing the exponential surge. Public health experts, however, also point the finger at the government for allowing super spreader events such as packed political rallies for state elections and a Hindu religious festival that saw millions congregate last month. They say policymakers also became complacent along with the public because they believed the virus was in retreat and did not pay sufficient attention when cases began rising. As to what is being done, the government says it is ramping up supplies of medical oxygen and reopening temporary COVID facilities that were shut down after the first wave. But on the ground, dire shortages persist. Even hospitals have been sending out SOS messages for oxygen. There were reports of patients dying in a southern city when a hospital ran out of oxygen on Sunday. Several major cities, such as New Delhi and Mumbai, are in lockdown in a bid to control the surge.
Anjana, I wanted to ask you about vaccine adoption in India because it's home to the Serum Institute, which is the largest manufacturer of vaccines in the world. But India has a woefully low number of inoculations.
Well, the problem is that the vaccination program has been riddled with shortages in recent weeks because authorities never anticipated the massive demand once the second wave came, and they believed that the virus was in retreat so they could go ahead with this kind of slow, measured program. It was also relying mainly on vaccines produced domestically, but according to health experts, steps were not taken earlier on to ramp up manufacturing or stockpile enough doses. I mean, it's a country of 1.4 billion people, so you know you need millions and millions of doses. For months, the program has moved at a sluggish pace. Only 2% have been fully vaccinated and about 10% have got one dose. India even sent vaccines to 80 countries earlier in the year as part of its push for what is called vaccine diplomacy. Of course, since then, authorities have suspended exports, allotted funds to two companies to expand production, and approved Russia's Sputnik V vaccine, which will be produced in the country. But, you know, all this is now going to take time. And meanwhile, it has opened the program to all adults above 18. But as I said, there are no stockpiles now. The Serum Institute, which was supposed to supply most of the vaccines, says it cannot be blamed because orders were only placed around March when cases began rising. And so the shortages will persist till July. That is a grim prospect for a nation where people are now desperate for jabs.
That was reporter Anjana Pasricha speaking to me from Mumbai, India. The Pentagon on Monday said that it had sent two planeloads of COVID-19 supplies to India, with two additional flights set to arrive sometime on Monday as well as Tuesday. In the United States, President Joe Biden addressed how the country was doing combating the COVID-19 pandemic. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has that report.
The president, following remarks on Monday afternoon at a community college in Virginia, was asked by a reporter when the country will reach herd immunity, meaning when will a sufficient percentage of the population be immune to the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 because of previous exposure or inoculation.
There's a debate into what constitutes herd immunity. Is it 70% of the population? Is it 68%? Is it 81%?
No matter the precise percentage, Biden says he thinks by the end of the summer we'll be in a very different position. And what is critical now, according to the president, is for everyone to get vaccinated. Steve Herman, VOA News at the White House.
Yemen has received 360,000 doses from the global COVAX vaccine sharing system, yet many Yemenis seem reluctant to get inoculated. Reuters' Megan Revelle explains.
In the disputed Yemeni city of Taiz, medical staff are working to inoculate the few who have shown interest in the COVID-19 vaccine. Yemen has received 360,000 doses from the global COVAX sharing scheme, yet take-up has been limited due to religious belief, vaccine distrust, or because of the dangers of war. Raja al-Maliki is the head of Yemen's health ministry in Taiz and said many locals believe the vaccine would break their fast during the holy month of Ramadan.
The total vaccine doses that arrived to Taiz province is 70,000 doses from a total 360,000 that arrived to Yemen. We started on April 21st, but the turnout has been very low. And it's very low because of two reasons. Firstly, the religious conviction that many people have that taking a shot in Ramadan breaks your fast. And this is a wrong religious fact that people believe and has led people away, including many healthcare workers.
There has been a dramatic spike in infections in Yemen this year, straining a health system already battered by war, economic collapse, and a shortfall in aid funding. The Iranian-aligned Houthi movement controls most of northern Yemen and parts of Taiz, and has been battling the Saudi-backed government since 2014. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, and millions rely on aid to survive. Checkpoints and snipers in the heavily militarized city make it hard for many to reach the main government-controlled hospital.
Reuters reporter Megan Revelle. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. An ethnic rebel group in Myanmar said that it had shot down a military helicopter Monday as fighting in the country's northern and eastern frontier regions intensified following the February 1st army coup. Domestic media also reported that a junta-appointed local administrator had been stabbed to death in the main city of Yangon. Violence has spiraled since the coup, with at least 766 civilians reported being killed by security forces, and increasing confrontation with ethnic armies on Myanmar's fringes and junta opponents in the cities and countryside. The junta disputes these figures and says that at least 24 members of security forces have been killed during the protests. The United Nations also estimates that tens of thousands of civilians have fled their homes to escape fighting between the military and insurgents based along the border. Greg Poling is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I asked him what this intensified fighting means for the region.
So the violence really puts ASEAN, and I would argue the whole international community, in a bind, because it presents a real conundrum. Is the international community's goal in Myanmar to stop the violence at all costs? Is that the end in itself? Or is it to get the military junta to return to democracy? And the problem is that it appears the only way the junta is ever going to return to democracy, at least in any reasonable time frame, is via violence. If the civil disobedience movement, combined with the ethnic armed organizations, puts so much stress on the military that they're forced to the table, because obviously the ASEAN diplomacy has already failed. And so that presents a real problem. Is the violence a means to a return to democracy, which is what the opposition would argue, or is it a path to a failed state in Myanmar, which would have terrible consequences for all of South and Southeast Asia?
So what if the fighting does continue? Is there a danger, since there is already conflict along some of the borders, that it could spill out into neighboring countries?
Not in any large sense. I mean, the borders of Myanmar have always been barely governed or ungoverned spaces, especially the Thai border and the Chinese border. This is why they're one of the reasons that there have been these long-run insurgencies ever since independence. I mean, the Karen insurgency on the Thai border is, by many accounts, the longest-running, continuous violence, insurgency in the world. And so the ability to operate across the Thai border has always been there, but it's never really spilled out in a way that threatens the stability of Thailand itself, or China in the north, in the case of the other ethnic groups. One of the other things that we have to always drive home is this weird narrative that Myanmar is headed towards civil war is kind of disingenuous. Myanmar has been in civil war for over 70 years. The question is just whether or not the ethnic armed groups actually have a chance to win, or at least actually have a chance to force the military to the table for the first time in decades.
Greg, I want to go back to something you mentioned just a moment ago, and that was the danger of Myanmar turning into a failed state. Should that occur, in your opinion, what would that mean for not only the citizens of Myanmar, but the region as a whole?
The impact for the citizens of Myanmar would be disastrous. This is a country that spent several decades, really 40 years, steadily falling behind all of its neighbors. And then in the wake of the junta taking power in 1988, went into 20 years of absolute isolation. I mean, worse than the North Koreans. They were under the worst sanctions, the most strict sanctions the U.S. has ever placed on any country. Then they get 10 years to breathe free air, or something like free air, 10 years to play with capitalism and democracy, and now the junta's back. So the level of humanitarian disaster that we could see, that we're already seeing, and that would certainly get much, much worse should the violence continue to escalate and the situation deteriorate and all governance end, can't be waved off. And for the region, I mean, there is certainly fear that, China will step into a vacuum. Some of that is probably legitimate. Some might be overblown. For Southeast Asia, though, the biggest problem that I think most of Myanmar's neighbors see is that they welcomed Myanmar into the fold of ASEAN, the regional organization, and now it's heading toward pariah status, and that undermines ASEAN's entire argument that they are the ones most capable of running their own regional affairs, because they can't do that if Myanmar, as a failed pariah state, is sitting in their midst.
That was the Center for Strategic and International Studies Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia, Greg Poling. Marking World Press Freedom Day on Monday, May 3rd, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, quote, "The global challenges we face during the COVID-19 pandemic underline the critical role of reliable, verified, and universally acceptable information in saving lives and building strong, resilient societies.
During the pandemic and in other crises, including the climate emergency, journalists and media workers help us navigate a fast-changing and often overwhelming landscape of information, while addressing dangers, inaccuracies, and falsehoods. In too many countries, they run great personal risk, including new restrictions, censorship, abuse, harassment, detention, and even death, simply for doing their jobs.
Living through and documenting the pandemic brought a multitude of challenges, especially for women reporters, according to the Coalition for Women in Journalism. VOA's Mariama Diallo has that part of the story.
The lockdown that began in March 2020 were key strategies used around the world to slow the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. Kiran Nazish is a journalist and the founding director of the Coalition for Women in Journalism, a support organization for women journalists.
As you know, journalists have to be on the front line and they have to be out there to be able to report. I think in the early March, we saw this complete sort of huge challenge where women journalists, especially freelancers, were facing this challenge of finding a job to be able to do.
As the pandemic took a toll on lives, governments took drastic measures, including closing borders and imposing quarantines to protect medical systems from being strained. But some of them also tried to control the storyline, she says.
We saw this in Turkey, Lebanon, Egypt, some of these countries, China, Pakistan, some of these countries use the opportunity of COVID-19 into politicizing the issue and creating misinformation about journalists who had been trying to do their job.
How so? She explains.
This has happened in Pakistan. I'll give you an example of one of our members, Asma Shirazi. Whenever she is reporting on, you know, the spread of the virus, government inefficiencies, or whatever, you know, whatever the government should be doing and they aren't doing, she's targeted with misinformation campaigns. We have several other similar incidents where women journalists have been impeded after reporting on COVID-19 in particular.
In Turkey, journalist Ebru Kucukaydin was taken into custody after one of her coronavirus reports and later released. The Turkish government accused her of creating panic. Other journalists, Malaysia's award-winning Wan Noor Hayati and The Guardian's Cairo correspondent Ruth Michelson, faced charges or were expelled or harassed for their coverage of the pandemic, the coalition says. Last year, the International Federation of Journalists surveyed nearly 560 female reporters from 52 countries and found that stress increased for 77% since the pandemic began. Catherine Gicheru leads the Africa Women Journalism Project in Kenya, an initiative started by the International Center for Journalists. She's seen the negative effects the pandemic has had on some women journalists in countries where gender discrimination is widespread.
This, I have reports also from the fellows in Tanzania and in Uganda, as well as in Nigeria, is the fact that if you have to work from home, then you're the one who's also taking care of the family. And that's 2, 3, 4 times the job that she was, a woman journalist was previously doing. And that is across the board. So you have a mental anxiety, the stresses, the fears that everybody has, but much more for women, especially women journalists.
She also says women journalists have been hit with job losses.
It's a problem all over the world, but a lot of journalists have lost their jobs. The women, a lot of them, especially in Kenya, are either on contract terms or are freelancers. And the fact that they've lost this, they've either been laid off or they've been put on half pay, it means they've become, the situation has become even more difficult.
And she says it has had an impact on coverage of other women-related topics, including sexual health, obstetric fistula, and female genital mutilation. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
German prosecutors have announced that they have busted one of the world's largest darknet child pornography platforms. AP correspondent Karen Chamas has more.
Prosecutors in the German town of Frankfurt said in a statement alongside the federal police that three German suspects believed to be running the platform were arrested along with one German user. One of the three main suspects was arrested in Paraguay. The platform itself, known as Boys Town, had over 400,000 registered members. The authorities said the platform had been active since at least 2019. Pedophiles used it to exchange and watch pornography of children and toddlers, most of them boys from all over the world. I'm Karen Chamas.
This is Science in a Minute.
So far, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory has sent its tiny Mars helicopter, Ingenuity, on four successful test flights, making it the first aircraft in history to make powered, controlled flight on another planet. The space agency found that the Mars helicopter's energy, telecommunications, and in-flight navigation systems have been performing so extraordinarily well that they will allow it to move on to a new phase of operational testing. NASA says Ingenuity's new testing phase will help it determine how using helicopters for aerial reconnaissance along with other functions can help advance not only the exploration of Mars, but with other worlds as well. The space agency says this new testing phase will begin in about 2 weeks with the helicopter's sixth flight. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Every evening during Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting, people break the fast in a celebration with family and friends in a meal known as iftar. During the COVID-19 pandemic, some have come together in communal celebrations through social media. And as Michael Sullivan reports, one organization in Los Angeles is using a virtual iftar to bridge the gap between Muslims and Jews.
Each day of Ramadan, iftar is a time for relaxation at sunset after a day of fasting.
Allahu Akbar, Allah.
This Ramadan, some in Los Angeles, California, are hosting a virtual iftar with an unusual interfaith flavor, says one Muslim participant.
We did the call to prayer from three different synagogues throughout the Los Angeles area, which was extremely, first of all, I thought it was very beautiful and very powerful. But secondly, it expressed for all of us the unity and fact that we are all one community.
The virtual iftar was sponsored by New Ground, a Muslim-Jewish partnership for change, and was held online this year with a welcome from Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. It included a virtual visit to the kitchen of an imam and his wife to watch them prepare their favorite iftar dishes, and a visit to the kitchen of a rabbi and her husband to see their favorite foods prepared. But participants say iftar and Ramadan are not just about food and fasting.
And I think some of the messaging from it is, you know, sacrifice, patience, empathy.
Growth. And strengthening bonds with others, including those of different faiths, says a Jewish participant.
We start with relationships. We start with telling our personal stories, dealing with our own identity.
And acknowledging differences, he says, while the sharing of personal moments helps to bridge the gap over divisive issues, like the difficult relations between Palestinians and Israelis that often separate Jews and Muslims.
But it also gave me a whole different vocabulary and a skill set for how to express myself and how to have difficult conversations.
The ongoing interactions through events like these, either virtual or in person, teach participants how to listen.
Long time ago.
We may agree to disagree a lot of times, but, you know, that's part of the process of understanding each other and actually being able to empathize with another person and their views.
Skills, they say, that are useful for people, whatever their background or religion. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
A Nigerian startup named WeLead exposes young boys in underserved communities to the world of digital literacy and equips them with the basic digital knowledge required to succeed in the 21st century. Deyoyi Lori is the founder of WeLead in Lagos, Nigeria, and she recently spoke with Africa 54's Paul Ndiho via Skype about her organization.
You run some training academies in Lagos, Nigeria. Can you maybe start by bringing me up to date what those training academies are all about?
Nigeria is a peculiar country where we have a lot of organizations working with women. However, we have identified that there is a gap in the boys' space, and of course, the gap in the women's space remains. So how do we match the two? That is how we came about Birthing We Lead, which started in 2017. We're doing most of our training in school. So we have groups of schools, and we're able to reach out to over 30 schools, training over 5,000 boys. However, when COVID struck, we moved our classes online. Hence, we then had We Lead Boys Academy, which, by the way, flourished. We were able to break borders. We were able to go beyond borders. And this academy graduates boys, taking them through our own curriculum, and we're able to graduate over 35 boys in 2020 alone.
You talked about something that I find very interesting, especially when you said you just focus on boys. A lot of people would argue that there are so many organizations out there that are trying to strike a balance, a focus on both young boys and young women. But for you, your particular interest is in boys. Why boys?
Going by statistics, if you go to correctional centers for young people, juvenile centers, you find that when you compare the juvenile center for girls with the one for boys, you find the number going about ratio of 7-3. So you have about the numbers of young people in the correctional center. You have more boys committing crime. You have more boys getting into trouble. You have more boys in the height of the storm. So why not focus on boys? We need a healthy balance between both genders. Hence our focus on boys. We see this gap clearly written. And if you talk to parents of boys, they will tell you that the society is actually sitting on a keg of gunpowder if we do not start talking to boys.
Interesting. You also talk about how you pay special attention to correctional facilities. Is there any reason why you chose to go into these facilities for younger men?
Yes, we are very deliberate about going to where we have the worst of cases. We thought to ourselves we need a long-lasting relationship. A long-lasting engagement, an engagement that leaves these boys whole. Once we are leaving them, we know that we had actually sown a good seed in their life. Hence, we decided we are going to go to the correctional centers. And we started with the correctional centers for boys already in Lagos. We worked with these centers for over a year, going there every weekend to teach our curriculum. These courses range from leadership to masculinity and sexuality, delayed gratification, failing forward, critical thinking. These are things that naturally will not be taught in schools.
Talk to me about the academy, the online academy. How are you able to interact with these boys when they're in these correctional facilities? Have you set up computer labs in some of these facilities?
Yes, our aim is to put systems, computer systems, in these facilities where we can teach these boys online. Parents bought into it. So boys from the UK, from the US, from Canada, from Ghana, from Nigeria, of course, logged into that program. We have about boys from about 7 to 8 countries.
When you interact with some of these boys, what are their stories? What are their aspirations? What is it that they want to do once they get out of these programs?
So when you talk to these boys, you have potentials. So you find boys aspiring to be musicians, to be doctors, to be lawyers, to be sportsmen. I mean, talents abound in the center. One Saturday that was one of the Saturdays we go to teach at the center. We got to the center and realized that one of the boys had just won a scholarship to study abroad. That was very, very heartwarming for us because it also shows that there are potentials residing in this center. And these potentials are just boundless. You need to hear, when these boys even speak, you're asking, why are you here?
Thank you so much for your time, Dayo.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.